Radio.
Southern African Perspectives on 1 Timothy 2, 11-15. A presentation by Dr. Benno Zuidam at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 Colloquium.
I've got the pleasant duty of a very difficult topic. People like us in the Christopher Dawson circles appreciate marriage and fight for that in modern society, but we do not always realize that marriage and family commitment in the history of Western civilization has more to it. There's a specific role, also authority model, that comes with it. And even if we look into our hearts as more or less conservative people today, we sometimes find it itching when we read biblical texts like 1 Timothy 2, where St. Paul says, "Let a woman learn in silence with all submissiveness. I permit no woman to teach or to have authority over men. She is to keep silent. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet woman will be saved through bearing children if she continues in faith and love and holiness with modesty." Just those few lines, and you realize that it doesn't sit well with political correctness today. But it did sit really well with all of Western civilization, from the days of Plato, Aristotle, right up to Immanuel Kant, the German Enlightenment philosopher, even the French Revolution in its initial stages. If I just take the example of pagan Aristotle, in one of his writings, Politics 4, he has a Greek poet quote, which literally says, "Gynaiki kosmon esi gepherai," which is translated, "A woman carries silence as cosmetics." Some have paraphrased that to silence is a woman's glory, and wrote articles on it, chastising old-fashioned views. It was a view of Greek civilization. Women didn't have the vote in Athens. It was democracy, but very different from what we know today. The early church had a similar approach in the wake of verses like 1 Timothy 2, 11-15. Women were excluded from authority and teaching in the early church. I just quote from St. Chrysostom's his ninth homily on 1 Timothy, where he reaffirms what Paul is saying, that woman was created for men as a help, that man was God's initial purpose with creation. And then he moves over to the fall and says, he's a little bit misogynistic, the woman taught once and ruined all. On this account, therefore, he says, let her not teach. But as far as the general thrust is concerned, this is what the early church taught and practiced. And the later church, the medieval church, confirms this. If we take the major exponent of Thomas Aquinas, quote, "Woman is in a state of subjection, wherefore she can have no spiritual jurisdiction, since the philosopher also says that it is a corruption of public life when the government comes into the hands of a woman. Consequently, a woman has neither the key of order nor the key of jurisdiction. Nevertheless, a certain use of the keys is allowed to women, such as the right to correct other women who are under them on account of the danger that might threaten if men were to dwell under the same roof." It's probably thinking of medieval monastery with an abbess and the nuns, and in that situation, it's perfectly proper that the abbess teaches the other nuns and commands them to do certain things. That all changed in later Western society. Some would say with the decline of Western society after the Enlightenment. Take the French Revolution as a turning point. No God, no master. Égalité, liberté, fraternité. Initially, the brotherhood only extended to brothers and not to women and not to black slaves. That's why the only successful slave revolt in a nation in Haiti took place not under the Ancien Régime, but under the new one, the democracy, the libertarians, 1793. But gradually that changed. End of the 19th century, the suffragette movement, which was a terrorism movement in its own right. When I first heard about it, I thought, oh, this was peacefully demonstrating women, and eventually they got the voting right. Wasn't like that at all. Around 1913, they discovered a huge bomb under the bishop's seat in St. Paul's Cathedral in London, with a time mechanism set up to blow up the bishop and the lot. That was the suffragette movement. And that's only one example. Something resonates. I think our bishop has to be careful. Look under your chair next time. But we move on in history and we find the Great War, whole generations wiped out, women necessary for the workforce, and gradually after that we get feminism, sexual revolution, liberating women in different way to take up political rights and a different position in society. The final stage of that neoliberalistic movement we're in today with the promotion of gay rights. So it's not a favourable climate to endorse 1 Timothy 2. So I thought what I do is look at what some other people said and look at my colleagues in South Africa. I've got quite a few in the New Testament Society. I've said things about 1 Timothy 2 in the 21st century. First one is Gerald West. He's from the University of Natal, in the east of South Africa, Durban, Pietermaritzburg. He was the first one to write on this. And Gerald considers this text a text of terror. Other theologians are of the same mind, but he actually called it a text of terror. Quote, "There are no easy answers here. Texts like 1 Timothy 2 are not easily tamed. Margaret Atwood's harrowing tale of a possible future world in which bits of the Bible are used to ensure that women are only saved literally through childbirth, and in which this text's other clauses are used to legislate that women should learn in silence with all subjection, is a chilling reminder of just how difficult it is to tame this text." And consequently, Gerald seeks what he calls an enabling voice of God to really overcome the text and its interpretations. He almost becomes Churchillian when he says, "We must take up each and every opportunity we get to contest and destabilize in the public realm of our communities and churches the interpretations we have inherited and which we continue to do so much damage." You're allowed to say that in research journals today if you come from that perspective. But had I written for the same journal and says, "We must with all our might endorse the perceptions that St. Paul envisages in 1 Timothy 2, my article would be considered unhelpful and it would be denied publication. So it's good to keep that in mind. So Gerald also knows what's good for him within his university context. Second colleague is Marietta Jacobs, Afrikaans-speaking lady professor at UNISA in Pretoria, used to be a great university which the world looked up to for distance education. She mainly considers the negative influence of this text on the history of the church. And she's mainly concerned with, we must expose the patriarchal roots of this passage. And wherever we expose a negative root for a text, we can say, oh, we don't do anything with that text anymore because we have identified this evil patriarchal root. So fortunately, we can cast it aside. She says it's an irredeemable text. When theologians use that, they mean we can't do anything with it today. And we have to devise a theory we can use to say that it was valid for then, but not for today anymore. Like if the Greek, Paul had said, the Greeks would take exemption if we have these liberated Christian wives who are warning Christ just like their husbands, etc., and do all the same things that would hinder the gospel in the situation of those conservative, evil, pagan Romans and Greeks. So for as long as that situation continues, our women should be submissive as well. That would be a proper hermeneutical way to say that it was only for then, but not anymore for today. And theologians have been looking for principles like that to say 1 Timothy 2 is no longer for today. Moretta also does, but she must admit that that cannot be done for several reasons I'll come back to later. She says it reveals the darker side of the Bible and its ongoing interpretations for contemporary people, the side which was and is often still rendered invisible by the unholy piety which characterizes so much of biblical interpretation, especially in a church context. At times, this rouses acute anger. However, if the exposure of the male madness of this past could lead to arguing and disagreeing with our sources and their patriarchal authors, this confrontation can become a therapeutic exercise. Good for us. A turning point, and thereby a starting point for going ahead in a different way. So in summary, she says this is an excellent passage to disagree with, and that's the only function it should have today. Moving to the south of South Africa, to the lovely mountain town of Stellenbosch, where we find Professor Elna Mouton writing together with a female colleague from Nijmegen University in the Netherlands. Nijmegen is the university that lost its Vatican endorsement some years ago because of their liberalism, and Schillebeeks is one of the names that might sound familiar to some of you. They try to say it's a context-specific appropriation of the creation story. Not sure whether you understand that, but I thought about that a little. What they intend to say is that, okay, these early Christians struggled with the will of God, trying to find it out, and in their primitive and limited way, they came up with this interpretation and solution. But that's only their interpretation and solution. It's not for us. Then they move on and do something very useful, and they say it doesn't work to read allegory or metaphor into this text, because this is something that a senior colleague of ours from America did in the Society of Biblical Literature some years ago, a professor called Kenneth Waters, and he said, no, it's not literal, this 1 Timothy 2. It's for men and it's for women, and it's just symbols that apply to both men and women. So he tried to explain away along those lines. But these two women professors say, you can't do that. You could do that perhaps in an egalitarian society like we have today. But if you do so in a patriarchal society, in a traditional society, like the one in the first, second century, then it does the very opposite. Because if you use patristic patriarchal images in a patriarchal situation, then it's only going to reinforce the patriarchal situation, because that's the images the people are used to, and they will just conclude that this author is pushing in that direction all the way. So it's not the solution, they say. There are only two options. The one is what they call boldly read the text against its patriarchal grain and intentions. And that's really questionable from a moral perspective, if not from a scholarly. If you're going to interpret a text against its very meaning and you know it. So I've got difficulty with that, and they probably do too. That's why they come with a second solution, and it's basically to discard the text and say it's irredeemable for today, better realize that and use it to disagree with, along the lines of Marietta Jacobs from UNISA. I'll take you up north of South Africa to Zimbabwe, where we find an education colleague, not a theologian, but someone who's with probably Harare University's Department of Education, Dr. Francis Machingura. He's mainly concerned with the fight against HIV, AIDS, and sexually transmitted diseases. And he finds that Bible verses like 1 Timothy 2 are hindering in that respect. So he says, we feel that it is our call to interrogate masculine readings of Bible texts like 1 Timothy 2 and urge women to speak up and be heard in challenging such readings. The call must involve our weaker groups of society, particularly women, the disabled, and children facing HIV and AIDS. And it's, of course, a terrible problem that he's trying to battle. So understand that. But his solution is, let the theologians be ventriloquists, let they make decisions about what in the Bible is words of men and what we cannot use any longer, and what on the other end is words of God that we still want to accept. And please let's throw 1 Timothy 2 out or interpret it in a different way. Let's have a politically correct Bible, because the continent of Africa has so many problems and those Bible verses are being misused and abused. And the neoliberal solution for that is, of course, to equip women with contraception and to empower them with positions of authority in the state, in politics, and also in the church. And according to their philosophy, all problems will be solved automatically after that. Last colleague, one of our university, the theological faculty, Dalbrecht, Northwest University in Potchefstroom, he comes with sort of solution that Paul addresses in 1 Timothy 2, the conduct of men and women in normal life or in marriage, rather than their respective behavior in worship. I would slightly disagree with that because of the textual context pointing to some elements of worship and certainly to the congregation. But at least Dalbrecht still considers the text prescriptive and authoritative. And it is only his exegesis that leaves room for traditional Africa values. Because the continent of Africa used to be, at grassroots level still is, very traditional in its family relations. It's been disturbed by the international business and by forcing people to work in the cities and go and live in shanty towns and be part of Western civilization that has done tremendous damage to family, traditional family relations and marriages in a black context. But in its heart, Africa, 3 years ago I had a stint of teaching at a black theological seminary for a month. Many of those Christians want to believe scripture and apply it in their lives, and also because of their culture have a far more conservative approach to family, to respectful parents, etc., than we have in our neo-liberated West. Why is 1 Timothy irredeemable for an egalitarian society or church? That's the big question after this inventory. Lots of failed attempts that indicate that it is. I don't have time to mention many of them. Perhaps I'll quickly mention one. In the United States, there's a theologian with the name Jamin Huebner. He's got an Orthodox background that started to think differently, and now he's sort of heading an institute to promote women involvement in the church. And he tries to argue that there are good ways in which a woman can take authority and bad ways, and that Paul is only arguing against the bad ways. And yeah, I can hardly begin to say why this explanation is failing. Let's grant him that you can translate that Paul is saying here, like the King James Version translate and the Vulgate as well, that I do not suffer a woman to take up authority over men. But the big question after that, Vulgate uses dominari, to dominate over men, to take up unlawful authority, usurp authority. But the second thing is that in the textual context, there's no suggestion whatsoever that Paul sees any realistic good ways in which a woman can take up authority over men. It's rather that any way of taking up authority is considered to be usurping. And it's also parallel with teaching. And if you teach a mixed company, it's also a way of taking up authority, because that is what teaching does. There's a German theologian, Heinz Werner Neudorfer, who points that out. He says that teaching in mixed company implies taking up authority over men. And it is exactly this what the apostle prohibits. Der Lehrer stellt nicht nur sein Denkvermögen aus, that the teacher doesn't only display some thoughts of his, sondern gebietet, but he commands. Die lehrende Frau gebührte also dem Mann, the teaching woman also commands man. Und dazu gibt Paulus ihre Erlaubnis nicht. As far as that is concerned, Paul doesn't give her permission. But the big thing, of course, is that the motivation of St. Paul is non-cultural. He refers to unchanging factors in the past or in the present. And those factors are creation, God's intentions with creation, the historical implications of the fall, and thirdly, indirectly, I'll come to that, the headship of Christ over his church. And we do hope that those things are unchanging factors and that Christ still is the head of the church despite our 21st century. But going to the first one first, a very important one, God's creation intentions. And some people would, with all respect to the rabbi, say that's only Old Testament stuff and we're liberated New Testament Christians. But you can't do that. Because if you take the New Testament, John's Gospel, who created all things? By whom was everything created that was? Jesus Christ, the Word who was God, became flesh, the incarnation. And that incarnation concept is so important in the old Christian Western worldview. There are a lot of things I could say about it, but remember the Pope who changed the times and is in some circles considered to be allied with Antichrist, Christ, because he sits on the throne of Christ and he changes the times. It's probably not from the tribe of Dan, but there were a few things. Pope Gregory changed the times in the 16th century from Julian to Gregorian. And that was not just fixing 11 days on the timetable, that was changing the concept of time. Because before Pope Gregory, we had annunciation years that circled around the incarnation of Christ. Because it wasn't Christ coming to earth in Bethlehem. No, it was the angel Gabriel, and 9 months after that, Christmas. That's how the initial church year was run and allocated, the incarnation of Christ, because Christ, who was involved in the creation of all things, came after the fall back by means of the incarnation, and to be in Eucharist and in spirit incarnate in the lives of believers and changes into a new creation, a recreation. So it's all about creation intentions and about recreation according to God's original purposes. That's what's involved here. So it's all of Christian theology, and it's sacramental in a way. So those creation intentions, man created, woman as a help, was not just the God of the Old Testament, but the same God of the Old Testament as in the New and through Christ, who is also the head of the church. And later on we see the Lord Jesus Christ arguing in the same way when he discusses marriage in Matthew 19, on the subject of divorce and marriage. When he says and points to revealed revelation in Moses, haven't you read that originally God created them male and female, etc. And what God had joined together, let no man put asunder. God's creation intentions. The Lord Jesus does it. St. Paul does it here in 1 Timothy 2. Then there's the fall, of course, which is difficult and unpalatable to many of us, certainly at times in my own heart, because none of us can help it, what Adam and Eve did thousands of years ago, but we all suffer the implications and the consequences. We can try to deny that, but the consequences of the curse are with us. And Paul says both because of God's creation intentions and the consequences of the curse I want to have things arranged in this way between men and women. Women now can't help it that they're daughters of Eve, and we cannot boast or help it that we are sons of Adam, who have to bear a particular curse as well. But those are spiritual realities, what C.S. Lewis called the rules of deep magic. There might have been 10 different solutions why Aslan wouldn't have to die and they could still fix it in such a way that Edmund was saved. But there wasn't, because of the rules of ancient magic that applied, the old spiritual rules bound to God, his creation, the way the universe works spiritually. So non-cultural reasons, and also the textual context, unmistakably patriarchal. Why? Because if you read on, after these verses about Adam and the woman, used generically, Hedegune, it's feminism's worst nightmare. The specific road to redemption is she will be saved through childbearing. So Thesaide diates technogonias. And that only if she continues to aspire to faith, love, and purity in all modesty. Look, this is the final patriarchal sting. Woman will be saved in a very relation to her husband. Admittedly, this phrase can also be translated as, but she will be kept safe through the ordeal of childbearing. There's an evangelical colleague in the United States who has argued for this, probably because he's somewhat afraid that there would be a different way to salvation than faith, and now woman is suggested to have a salvation route through childbearing, and then thinks that can't be, so we have got to think up something differently. And it can be translated like that, but does that make the passage better from a feminism point of view? Look, we've got lots of medicine, excellent medical care these days, but those were the days when 2 or 3 out of women, out of 10 women died in childbirth or because of infection afterwards. So with this interpretation, the apostle is saying, you know, you'll be safe through childbearing, but remember, lots of women die when they do. And you'll only be saved if you've got sufficient faith and worse, purity and modesty. And if you still die, then people will look at you and wonder whether you had sufficient modesty or purity. I'm not sure whether the interpretation of this text should go that way and opt for that translation. But it's clear that it doesn't work from a feminism point of view in any way. That's why all of those theologians concluded can't. Briefly, the wider context of this letter tells us that this is not a question of misogyny. I want to be very clear about that and give you a few quotes from the epistle as well. The thrust of this pastoral letter is that all Christian conduct, especially by male leaders, because 1 Timothy is directed towards a male leader, a bishop of the church, who's probably working in Ephesus at the time. And it would be that same letter to the Ephesians, Ephesians 5:28, that points to the husband is ahead of his wife like Christ of the church. But this letter tells us that all leadership behavior should be marked by love, in faith, in purity, 1 Timothy 4:12. He explains this at the very start of his epistle, but the aim of such instruction is love that comes from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith, 1 Timothy 1:5. In a practical way, this is expressed in man's respectful attitude to women. Are they still holding doors for ladies these days? They used to in the past. Wonder for a second why. The old attitude wasn't misogynic necessarily. In some situations it was. And there was a lot of discrimination and evil use of women, and there's still on the African continent and elsewhere. Look at the domestic violence in Tasmania. So that's not the issue. But the Apostle Paul argues in a very different direction. Be respectful, loving, pure as you deal with women. Also care for them socially. The care for widows is especially encouraged. He says, and whoever does not provide for relatives and especially for family members has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. 1 Timothy 5:8. And he also says to the older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, with absolute purity. And all of these injunctions are carefully aimed to provide a safe environment for women, where they are cherished, respected, and valued. Conclusion, a way forward. I think there are only two ways forward when you sum up what the theologians say about this passage, what Scripture and the Church have said over many years. First is preferring a traditional interpretation of this text, as the Church has done, and also the cultural heritage of the African continent would sit well with that, over and against the prevailing Western socio-political pressures of the 21st century. Admittedly, this is not a popular solution today, I realize that, but it carries textual weight and also scholarly integrity, because we don't have to twist a primary source and its meaning. So in that respect, it would be admirable to opt for that. The only other solution is what I call the wildlife solution. That's, if you see an African lion right here, we would all be screaming and making our way out, because he would be much better off in his natural habitat. He wouldn't be happy here, and we wouldn't be happy in his present, because he terrifies us, just like 1 Timothy 2 is a text of terror to neoliberalism. Then it's much better to agree to disagree, because a finishing school for young lions is bound to be a futile attempt. I thank you so much.
That was Dr. Benno Zoidem with Southern African Perspectives on 1 Timothy 2, 11-15. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 colloquium on the theme, The Nature of Men and Women, Complementary but Different, which was hosted in Hobart, Australia. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.